welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and I'm delighted to have you with me today. And today we're going to talk about kidney transplantation and living with end-stage renal disease, which is a degradation of renal function. So it's not an easy course, and we'll talk with a family that's been through this for more years than they would like to know about, but it's a journey that I think we all should know about, because the focus of the discussion is going to be how we can diagnose the problems earlier and hopefully avoid the degradation of renal function to the point where dialysis and transplantation become necessary. But if we do wind up going down that path, it is possible to tread it and to live and be well with renal function substituted by dialysis and transplantation. So before we introduce our guest today, I'd like to tell you a little bit about our sponsor. This program is brought to you each week by the VHL Family Alliance. VHL is a complex syndrome that causes, amongst other things, tumors in the kidney, which can lead to a loss of renal function. So we hope that you'll learn about VHL. Let me tell you a little bit of information about VHL, and you can explore on our website, too, to find out more about us and hopefully support the work that we do.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Welcome back. And at this point, I'd like to introduce our guest today. She's written a very lovely little book called Shades of Life, and it's Mrs. Vasundhara Ramanujan. And Mrs. Ramanujan, I think you're joining us from Asia, is that correct?
Yeah, Welcome. Hi. This is Vasundhara. Hi. I'm calling from India.
From India. Well, welcome. Yeah. It's wonderful that you were able to join us today. So, so tell us, your son was diagnosed with kidney problems at a very young age. He was a teenager, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah, he was 15 years and a half, and he had something which was a congenital problem that led to a kidney failure, which went unnoticed, undiagnosed, and very late we came to know that his kidneys had failed, and we had to prepare ourselves. We had to choose between the two options, to succumb to the life-threatening disease or to fight the disease. So as a family, we decided to fight the disease. So here
right.
I am talking
to you
about
it. There was no history of kidney problems in your family, right?
Yeah, there was no history.
So you had no warning, no expectation that there might be something wrong. How did you first determine that there was a problem with his kidney?
It happened that one morning he had this very severe headache, and we went to the practitioner, general practitioner, and mm-hmm. the doctor checked his blood pressure. When she checked the blood pressure, she realized that his blood pressure was very high for a young boy. So we were asked to do a blood test, so we went to the lab and we did the blood test, and the creatinine was at 4.58, which was very high for, when the normal range is like 1.1 milligrams per DL. So this was very high.
Right, and obviously headaches can be caused by many, many things. So you're lucky that they got to the seat of the problem very rapidly.
Yeah, we were lucky that she just checked the blood pressure. And in fact, you know, normally young kids, young people don't have blood pressure. So it was like one big surprise for all of us when it was found that he had high blood pressure.
Right, that's very unusual in children. And yeah. And you said it was really high. It was like 140 over 90 or something, which is...
Yeah, the blood pressure was high.
They used to say 100 plus your age. And now they even like it lower than that. But 100 plus your age, you should have been at 115 over 70 or 80 and not 140 over 90. So that's quite high for a child.
Yeah, it was a big shock and was very difficult for us to understand how to take this forward. But we had to go to the doctor, to the nephrologist, who asked us to conduct some tests. The ultrasound was done, the sonography, and they found out there was a valve, you know, which has a defect, which was a defected valve between the kidney and the bladder. So the urine was going back from the bladder to the kidney and damaging the kidney.
Right. So there's a valve between the kidney and the bladder, which is supposed to be one-way traffic, right? The urine's supposed to go from the kidney to the bladder. But because of this faulty valve, it was sometimes backing up into the kidney and causing problems.
Right, you're right.
Right. So so that was really an interesting problem, and I'm sure a tremendous shock for you all to find out that your little boy's kidney wasn't working the way it was supposed to.
Yes, it was shocking, but then I think we just collected our... and we said, well, we have to just find a solution for this. So we went about, arranging his diet according to the renal diet, where the protein has to be, you know, your diet has to have low protein and low salt so that the kidneys can manage to continue to do its function, the limited function that it was doing, because the kidney was already 80% gone. So we had to wait till... the creatinine went up to about 9 or 10 when the dialysis would start. So the first thing was...
They checked the creatinine level in the bloodstream, and that's a measure of how well the kidney is operating. Is that right?
That's right. It gives you the function of the kidney.
Right. So they have these numbers that tell them the kidney is working well or badly, and when it gets to 10, it's probably not working much at all. I think normal is around 1, is that right?
Yeah, 1.1 or 1, around that range. And Aditya's was at 4.58, which was high. And when it goes to about 9 or 10, then they start them on dialysis.
Right, because there are toxins that build up in our bloodstream. So, we think about kidney making pee, but the reason it does that is not only to get excess fluid out of our bodies, but also to take certain toxins out of our bodies.
Yeah.
So the kidney has a filtration role. It filters things out of our bloodstream and takes the waste products out of our bloodstream and puts them out as urine.
The other thing that kidneys do is also balance the chemicals in our body, you know. They just say that, okay, if this is the type of protein that the body requires, and this is the level of potassium that it requires, and these are the type of things that are required in the body, they just maintain that level. And when the kidney is stopping to function, so what happens is there's the buildup of protein, buildup of potassium, buildup of fluids, and these don't get... out of the system very easily. So that's where the problem happens. It's like it's really impossible for us to visualize that one day we will just not pass urine. You know?
Right.
And you think that, okay, today, tomorrow is going to be our day when I will not pass urine. The amount of discomfort that a person can face is enormous. You can't realize what it would be if you didn't go to the loo and just pee. So
exactly. And, you know, it's interesting because it's one of those things that we totally take for granted. You know, it just normally it just works and we don't even think about it. But as you say, if you weren't able to pee out that excess fluid, if you weren't able to take the excess protein or the various kinds of toxins and waste products out of our blood and get rid of those, then what happens? And when your kidneys stop functioning, you get a crash course in all the incredible things that a kidney does for you behind the scenes. So you get to manually manage, as you said, we have to manage our intake because we can't manage our output. So we have to manage how much protein goes into the body, how much potassium. I mean, do you even know? Yeah, I know you do, but the other people listening to this program, I bet you don't even know what foods have potassium and which ones don't. You might know about bananas, but there's a whole long list of things, and you get to manage phosphorus. Do you know what foods contain phosphorus? It's very interesting. All the things that we get to learn and manage manually that our body just auto-magically handles for us in the background.
Yeah, that's the important thing of the kidney, which has been somehow underestimated, and we've never known the function of the kidney. As much as we know that it produces urine, we didn't know that, it also takes care of removing all the other toxins. So what is the potassium? Potassium is also in spinach. It's there in chocolates. So, you know, things like a potato, French fry is something that, you know, you just cannot think that you will live a life without having a chocolate or a banana or French fries. So
right.
It is actually, you know, and for when it happens to a child so young and he probably is looking forward to having more meals like that, it's like suddenly cutting off something very important part of his life. And then learning to live without these things and managing, you know, becomes a big responsibility for the person going through the disease. It is also the family responsibility, because the family has to be, be sensitive to what the child or the patient requires. It may not be a child, it may be an adult. But if the adults can't have, you know, you can't just sit and have a bar of chocolate in front of them and make them feel bad. So it becomes a total change in the whole environment in the family. The whole household goes through a lot of change. It's also emotional. It's also to do with the diet. Conditioning ourselves that, yes, now we have to do something to take care of ourselves. And health is very important, and that is one thing that we need to protect.
Right. Yes, you speak in the book about just controlling salt and spices, which, of course, in the Indian diet are there all over the place. You know, there's so many things that have salt,
because
and spices make it interesting. And to have to limit those, not only, as you say, for your 15-year-old, but then for the whole family. And the whole family is suddenly thinking, this is not such an exciting diet as we were used to.
Yeah, it is that way. Just a change in lifestyle is required, and people have to understand that, yes, this is important for saving your life. Because it is, you know, it is just unbelievable. I have spoken in my book about the dialysis, and my son went into hemodialysis, and subsequently at one stage he went into peritoneal dialysis. And if one day the machine did not function, we would go crazy. We would not know what to do. You know, we would even warm up the solution in the microwave so that it comes to the body temperature, and then he would dialyze. So if you cannot remove the toxin from your body, it is impossible to even feel happy about yourself. It's so.
Right.
It's something that you can't imagine. And,
right.
This has not been talking. This has not been spoken enough, you know, by people.
Right. There's a prayer in the Jewish religion that the kids refer to jokingly as the bathroom prayer, but it's saying thank you for keeping the holes in our body that's supposed to be open, and the holes in our body that are supposed to be closed. We take that all for granted, but it's so true that if one of those holes that's supposed to be open is suddenly closed, or if one of the ones that's supposed to be closed is suddenly open, that's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, we just don't understand.
And, right, so there's a balance in intake and in output, and when you go through renal disease, there more than one major change in diet,
yeah,
because
yeah,
the diet that you use for a wounded kidney is very different than the diet you have to go through when you're on dialysis.
Yeah.
Right?
It changes at every stage, you know. You go on a diet before the dialysis starts, you go on a low salt and you low protein, and you blanch you boil your vegetables first, blanch it, and then cook your meals. So you know, whole lot of vitamins, minerals, everything is removed from the whole diet that you consume. And there's a water limitation that you can't have more than 2 liters of water, which means fluid of any kind. You know, it's not water. It's fluid. Any fluid that you intake, it should be like 2 liters between one dialysis
juice
and the other.
Juice
and the
soup
other.
And anything liquid gets counted.
Yeah. So all this is something very interesting.
Right.
And
so,
when
you have a wounded kidney, you know, either through surgery or through the deterioration of function, you have a kidney that's there but it's not working right and you want to support it, you have to go through all these limitations, as you say, with salt and taking all the potassium and phosphorus out of the food before you eat it, and limiting protein. Okay, so now we've gotten used to that diet. Now we go on dialysis. Tell us what the shake-up in diet is now.
When you're on dialysis, the type of dialysis you do is makes the difference, you see. In peritoneal dialysis, you can consume a little of potassium. You can consume little foods with phosphorus. That is, you can take dairy and you can take eggs and, maybe you take off the yolk and have the white. So you can have a little of all this. But, you know, in the peritoneal dialysis, these things get removed in the dialysis because it gets done every day. The peritoneal dialysis is an everyday process. Whereas hemodialysis is done thrice a week, so it comes alternate days. You see, so you know you just miss maybe a Monday or Wednesday and Friday. Then there's a Saturday, Sunday. So you know you have to be very careful when hemodialysis on your diet. Peritoneal dialysis is more relaxed. You know, you can just enjoy your meals. Because every night you have dialysis and you remove the toxins and the extra fluid.
Right.
So
but you still have things like no potatoes and no tomatoes.
Yeah.
And there are a whole bunch of things that we don't think as being the wrong things to eat. I think more people know about the diabetes diet than any of the other restrictive diets. And this one is much more complex.
More complex because, you know, what happens is it also depends on your blood results. So when you get your blood test results, you know that phosphorus is high. So, yeah, you have had a little more dairy last week. So you have to be conscious that the next time you do, before the next period of your test, you try to control and see that you bring the levels down. Because all this will impact the function, the kidney function. So, you know, you have to be all constantly watching and discuss with your doctor and your dietitian and find out exactly where your things are going wrong. And sometimes it's also change of medication that happens so that it improves all this. You know, the whole thing gets better with proper medication. Like,
my son was on dialysis
Pardon me?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
For phosphorus, they have something like, the binders. So those help to bind the phosphorus so that, you know, it can get out of the system. It can be removed.
Yes, but it's a constant, complex balancing act. I know my son was on dialysis for 2.5 years, and he said that the dialysis diet was the undiet. You know, take everything you ever learned about dietary requirements and turn it upside down, you know. Red meat preferred and no tomatoes and no potatoes and, you know,
and
no
white
orange
bread.
Juice.
You know, you have to take white bread instead of the brown, the whole wheat.
Right.
And then when you change your diet, after the transplant, you can have your whole meat and you can have your other stuff. And then in my son's case, you know, he lost his kidney, the one I donated in 1999, mm-hmm. I donated my kidney. He lost it in 2006. So he went back into a dialysis diet. And then he again had a transplant in 2009. And again, he had to go back to another diet. So it's like always relearning whatever you have done or changing your whole life, changing your pattern of looking at life. It's a whole lot of complex.
Right. But it certainly does give us a keen appreciation for what those little organs are doing for us.
Yeah. So how is your son doing now?
He's doing well, thank you. He has a transplant from me that he has from 2001. And so far, so good. We hope it continues to work well.
Yeah, and I hope
your son's transplant goes well as well. So let's talk a little bit about dialysis. You've mentioned hemodialysis and peritoneal dialysis. I'm not sure all our listeners know those terms. So let's help them understand them a little bit. So hemo, that means blood. Hemodialysis is when you pass your blood through the artificial kidney machine, and it filters the bad stuff out of the blood just the way the kidney is supposed to do. But, of course, it's only a kind of crude approximation of what a little kidney is able to do. But it certainly takes the most important, it balances the most important things. And then you mentioned peritoneal dialysis. The peritoneum is a part of our anatomy near the stomach. It's that part of the abdomen. And so you have experience with that and I don't. Tell us a little bit about how one accomplishes peritoneal dialysis and what the pros and cons are.
Peritoneal dialysis is with the peritoneum, the catheter is fixed there, so the dialysis happens with that. And there's a machine, which is called a cycler machine. There are two, three types of peritoneal dialysis. My son Aditya did one with the cycler machine. So the dialysis happened every night. So, you know, you could eat a normal meal. Okay, you restrict your potatoes, you restrict your tomatoes. You can have one meal, you can break your diet and say, okay, let me have French fries. But you have to be careful how the quantity you consume. It has to be just a few of, you know, the fries so that you can just enjoy yourself a little. So the dialysis happens every night. The machine, the cycler machine, removes the fluid, the extra fluid. It removes all the toxins. And the machine goes on. There are about four cycles. So it does it in four cycles. There is some fluid that comes into the body and it drains out. And finally, at the end of the four cycles, the complete body thing has been purified. Your blood and your system is completely purified. It's very clean. So potassium is still a problem to remove with the dialysis. So your restriction on potassium has to still continue.
Right. So in peritoneal dialysis, first they make this pocket in your stomach cavity, right?
In your abdominal
cavity, I should say. It's not in the stomach. It's near the stomach.
Yeah.
And they make an input valve and an output valve, right?
Output valve,
And then there's this dialyzing solution that you pump into that cavity.
Yeah.
And then it flows out. So it goes in, soaks up the toxins and whatever, and then comes on out. Is that more or less right?
That's right. So the first thing that happens is, it drains. When you connect yourself onto the machine, first it drains out all the things that is there in the body, the fluids that has already accumulated in the past 24 hours, that gets drained. And then you're taking some more fluid, so that the dialysate solution goes in, and then that cleans the system again. So again it comes out, and then there are four cycles. And then by the end of by morning your complete dialysis is over. It takes about 10 hours of dialysis.
Hours. So you can do it more or less while you're relaxing and sleeping, right?
Yeah, sleeping, and you can do anything. You can watch television, you can read, you can do your homework.
Right.
You can do many things around that time. In fact, peritoneal dialysis...
It's more convenient because otherwise, In hemodialysis, you go to a center. Sometimes there are local centers, but it might also be in a hospital itself. And you go there, and they hook you up to the artificial kidney machine, and they take your blood and pass it through the artificial kidney machine, and then it'll go 3 or 4. My son was on 4.5 hours 3 times a week, and you said your son was a little bit less than that. But nonetheless, it's a lengthy process, and my son used to say it was like a part-time job, you know, because it's 4.5 hours plus transportation times 3 times a week, that's essentially a 20-hour-a-week part-time job, away from family, away from work, and you had to plan what you were going to do with yourself while you're sitting there through this process in the bed. So the peritoneal dialysis allows you to have a little bit more of a normal configuration to your day.
That's right. It's more convenient. It gives you more time to do what you want to do. And you can even time your dialysis. Suppose you want to go out for a movie, you can come back and you can hook onto your machine by 12 o'clock in the night and finish your dialysis later in the day. So there is a flexibility. It's not that every day you can do that. You need to have the dialysis done at a particular time so that you're not uncomfortable. But there is a lot of flexibility.
It's more about the intervals, right? As you mentioned with the hemodialysis, if they do it 3 times a week, let's say Monday, Wednesday, Friday, then there's a bigger space between Friday and Monday that there was between Monday and Wednesday. So you have to remember that. And they always say, remember that everything you drink is going to be on board until your next dialysis session.
That's right.
So that 3-day weekend becomes a problem because now you've got another 3 pounds of fluid on board.
Yeah. The thing is, on weekends, generally, you like to also enjoy yourself, and that's when you get restriction is more because you have to be very particular about the next dialysis you do. And if you do it on a Monday afternoon, so you have a longer wait time then.
Right.
You'll be anxious. You'll want to go first and get the dialysis done in the morning, first thing in the morning.
Yeah.
But it won't happen that way because your schedule will be sometime in the day, anytime, maybe it's the afternoon.
Right. And having those little treats in our diet is one thing. I remember my son saying once in a while he would go in and say, okay, I just had a large orange juice, so please take it off. You have to remember, when you can vary your diet and by how much and when's your next dialysis.
In fact, my son would have something just before he goes to dialysis. He'll say, okay, let me have something so that it can get removed in the dialysis. So that was one thing that he would do off on, but, you know, I would not recommend that because it's not the right thing to do. You have to be a little careful about what you eat. And you can't make such concessions for long. It's a treat, yeah. Sometimes you should enjoy yourself and give yourself a break and just laugh it out and say, yeah, this is something else you have to worry about.
So as you say, this then became a commitment on the part of your entire family for the rest of the time since your son was 15, right? And it's ongoing.
Yeah, like in our 15 years, we've been with talking about the disease. So many complications. The peritonitis was there and so many things happened. In all this, what came out was the feeling that you have to be there to support the family. All the members have to be committed to it. Everyone should feel the need to help out, you know, to be supportive and to give, be with the right attitude, you know. Because my son was very positive, but if the family members were all coming out with different vibes, it would have been very difficult for him to maintain his positivity.
Right.
Very early, sometime in 1997, I was detected with breast cancer. That is a little before I donated my kidney. My kidney was donated in 1999, but this happened in 1997. I was detected with breast cancer, and I had to do a treatment. I had to go for the surgery, the mastectomy. Then I had to do chemotherapy, and then I had to do radiation. And finally, when I finished all my treatment and I was cleared by my oncologist. I was cleared and he said, yeah, now you can consider your transplant. Then I went and donated my kidney. So these are the things that helped my family move on, you know. We just said, okay, let's finish with this cancer bit. Let's take it out of our way. So at every stage, we just left things behind and we did not carry it forward.
I'm amazed that they approved you to be a kidney donor after chemotherapy and radiation.
It was a very tough call because, you see, I had already done my test sometime in April 97, May 97, before my breast cancer was detected. Few days before that, I had my test, and I was cleared, and everything was positive. The HLA match was there, and I could donate my kidney. And suddenly this thing came out, and it was like a huge bolt for us, because my husband is diabetic, and he can't donate. And my other son, yep, Dhananjay, is a year and a half older than my 15-and-a-half-year-old. So he was 17 years, so it was like very difficult for me to make a decision. So
sure,
we just went with the treatment. I just got myself cured. And I had to beg with my son's nephrologist. I had to tell him that this is impossible. There's nobody else in the family who can donate. My sister was not the same blood group. My sister-in-law was not in the same group. And so it was not possible, and we just had to go ahead. And there was no way my son was going to take an outside donor, because in India it was very easy to find a donor since the organ trade was rampant at that time. So it was very easy for me to find a donor. But my son was very clear that he would take only a family-related organ donation.
So in India, do they pay people when they donate a kidney?
They do, but it's a very small, it's a very trivial amount compared to what goes out from the pocket, from the recipient's pocket. The amount actually the donor receives is very, very negligible. That's why we are against that, the organ donation. Taking the organ from a third party, unrelated donor.
I see. Okay. Because in many countries, including the United States, there is no payment to the donor, but of course the donor's medical expenses are paid by the recipient or the recipient's insurance. So it doesn't cost the donor anything, but there's no other compensation. Right.
I believe that's the right approach, and we should honor that. It's only a family who goes through this, can understand how desperate one can get when you can't find a kidney and the person is going through dialysis.
Right.
My son never complained during dialysis. He was very cheerful. He just made me feel that, this is also okay. Nothing too bad about it. But I don't think it is possible for everyone to feel the same way, I have seen patients who have suffered a lot during dialysis. And I know that for them it's a desperate measure. You just need a kidney. If the family members can donate, I think the desperation will be less.
I've heard some patients say that that their doctor says, no, this patient is not well enough to have a kidney transplant. We have to wait until they're better. But the problem is you don't get better when you're on dialysis. You're not going to get better until you have a kidney. And it's really amazing the difference that little kidney makes. A lot of people who are on dialysis, like your son the first time, have a little bit of kidney in place, doing a little bit of what kidneys do. And even if it's not making pee, it may be helping to balance some of those chemicals. It may be still telling your bone marrow to make red blood cells. So you may not get quite as anemic as someone who has zero kidney in them. My son lost his kidneys to kidney cancer. So when he went on dialysis, he had no kidneys in his body at all. And there was no filtration of any toxins in his blood, and he itched nonstop for 2.5 years.
And three days
after the kidney transplant, he stopped itching. Okay. So it was really amazing to watch.
Phosphorus was too high in the body.
Yeah, so there was some toxin that that they don't even know. They couldn't identify. They couldn't do anything about it. But the kidney knew. And it just went in there and started cleaning house. And he did really, really well with his transplant. So it makes an enormous difference. And for everybody listening out there, just so you know, there people who are on dialysis really, really benefit enormously, more than just making pee. Their whole lives will be turned around when they have a transplant. So if you're in a position to help anyone in your sphere to get a transplant, please do. I know people say to me, oh, you were so brave to do that kidney transplant. Tell me your feelings about how it was for you to give a kidney to your son.
I think I was very happy to give the kidney because I was just waiting to do that. It was like from 96 November when he was detected to 1999 May when the kidney was donated to him. My only thing, only aim in life was to donate the kidney. I did not think anything beyond that. The cancer came, it went. It didn't matter to me. So when I gave the kidney, the first few months, we were very anxious because he was going in and out of the hospital, and we didn't know what was happening. And finally, when he settled down with the kidney, I managed to ask him that, with a lot of reservation, I asked him, Aditya, how are you feeling? So he told me that this is the first time I have felt so good after the kidney transplant. I'm able to pee completely. So I'm not holding back any urine, and I'm passing urine so comfortably. So that was those words were like music to my ears because I did not expect him to say something. So it was so trivial, you know, going into the toilet and peeing is such a trivial day-to-day function. And we don't realize that a child has had this problem and he could not tell us that he was having this problem, that he was not peeing properly.
Right.
So, if parents are a little more alert, and I keep telling myself, maybe I should have found out something, maybe some indications. I missed out something. And if I had noticed something and if I had made a change for my child, it would have been a huge thing. I would have saved his kidney, maybe.
Yes, you mentioned that one of the reasons that you wrote this book was to help parents realize that when there may be early warning signs that there's something wrong with your child's kidney, tell us what you learned in retrospect about signs that you might have learned about that would have given you clues that there was a problem brewing.
My son was bedwetting till he was detected with the kidney failure. And when we did the sonography and we did all sorts of tests, and when we did the x-ray and whatnot, and then my doctor just asked me, do you have anything that you have not told me? So I said, I was a little embarrassed, and I told him that he has been bedwetting, and so he said, oh, that's one clue that we have missed. You know, the reflux, if a child has got a reflux, that is, the urine is going back and forth from the bladder to the kidney, and if he is bedwetting, we could have easily found out the reflux, because if we had done the test earlier, we would have known that we had done the sonography earlier, we would have known that the valve is weak, and that there would be a corrective surgery to make the valve stronger. They would do an implantation of a valve, or they do some grafting, and they improve, make that valve a little stronger. So then the kidneys would not have failed. So I should have, ideally, I went to a doctor when he was about 10 or 12. I don't know exactly the date, I mean the time when I went. So when we went to the doctor, a urologist, he said that Aditya would be fine when he grows up. And so we just took it for granted. We should have taken a second opinion then, which we didn't do that. Because, that was one big mistake that I made. But when you have children growing up, you know, you're so busy with their schedules, you don't think about it too much because the doctor has said that as he grows up, it will become normal and he'll be all right.
Yeah, he'll grow out of it, you know. You're right. Yeah. So many of children's complaints get fobbed off like that. Oh, you know, he's just, boys will be boys, or he'll grow out of it, or, you know,
yeah,
he's a teenager, he's trying to get out of school. So many of children's complaints are discounted. And we really need, as parents, we know our kids. We know this is a child who doesn't want to go to school, or this is a child who doesn't lie to me. If he tells me that he has this complaint, this is real, and I need to take this to the doctor and insist that we need to look into this deeper. But, you know, hindsight is 20/20, as they say, you know.
Yeah.
It's easier to look back and see our mistakes than it is to see when we're in the middle of them. So we can't fault ourselves. There's no point feeling guilty
about it. No, I don't feel bad about it.
But at least it's wonderful that you're sharing this so that other people just might be able to pick up on it.
Yeah, because if the child is bedwetting after 4 to 6 years is the time, you know, he should have finally finished by 6 years, the bedwetting episode, and they should have a normal, your toilet habits. So if they miss that, and if it's something that the child can be taken to the doctor, the parents should do everything possible to find out whether everything is okay with the child, and whether he will stop bedwetting or whatever the precautions that he can take.
Mm-hmm.
But they must make that effort to find out why he is bedwetting if the child bedwets after 6 years. There's no way to hold on.
Right, and as you said, these were not extravagant tests. These were checking his blood pressure and doing some normal blood test work to see what the creatinine level was. And so these are tests that we all should insist on having on a fairly regular basis for our children.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't say the blood pressure, and blood pressure may not have come at that stage, you see. The blood pressure comes in when the kidney has failed. So when the bedwetting is a day-to-day, a constant thing, it's an everyday habit, and the child bedwets every day, and he or she is about 6 years, they need to consult the doctor and find out what is the problem, why is it persisting, why isn't he giving, why is he bedwetting? We have tried to train the child, but things are not working out. You know, that's when the doctor has to be approached, maybe a urologist or a specialist who can, even a child specialist can tell you what is the problem. But we feel very shy to talk about, you know, bedwetting. We feel, oh, it's so embarrassing to talk about bedwetting. And my son Aditya was very keen that I write this book and I write this whole message about bedwetting so that people can be alerted in good time and they can find a solution to such a problem. Apart from bedwetting, it's also urinary tract infection, you know. That's another thing that people need to see, that it's completely cured if the child, even if an adult has a urinary tract infection, see that you take the treatment completely.
That's right. And if you have repeated urinary tract infections, it's like having repeated ear infections. That signal that your body has still got a problem here and that may not be looking deeply enough.
Yeah, so you need to do that. And for people with diabetes and high blood pressure, I would say that they have no reason to let their kidneys fail. If they can control it and take their medication properly. Because, you know, after going through seeing my son go through dialysis and go through the transplant and so many issues that we have any infections and whatnot, the hospitalizations were so many. I think that it's not worth doing all this, you know. If you can protect
your kidney, you can avoid it. It's much, much better. And and as you say, even for diabetics, it's not the diabetes per se that causes the kidney failure. It's the persistent high blood pressure. We need to control that high blood pressure as well as the sugar, as far as that goes.
Yeah.
But anybody with high blood pressure, it has to be controlled or it can damage your kidneys.
Yeah. So we just need, this is a message that needs to go out to everyone.
Right.
That actually,
so
my
how's your son doing now?
He's doing well. He's finished his doctorate. Like from 15 years, he did his he did science in the undergraduation. Then he went to the Indian Institute of Technology, which is a very prestigious institution in Mumbai, in India, where he did his master's in physics. Then he did a doctorate in physics from the University of Southern California. Now he's doing a postdoctorate in the Alberta University, Canada. So he's doing well. Academically, he's doing well. So he's feeling very nice about his life, in spite of having problems regularly and persistently. Things happen, go wrong now and then, even after the transplant. There are some eyes in it. There are some good days and some bad days. So it's okay. We can live with
it. But he's relatively stable with his new transplant?
He is stable, but, you know, there are some problems keep coming now and then. You know, the first transplant is always a better one. The second one comes with its own, you know, load of problems. So better to watch out for the first kidney and to see that it continues for a longer time.
And his brother was 22 when he gave the kidney?
No, my son is now 31. So the elder
31.
Son gave him... Yeah, there is only a year and a half difference. So last, in 2009, he gave the kidney.
Right.
29 years, yeah.
Okay, so he was 29 when he did it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
A lot of people worry, you know, that that's young and you have many years ahead of you. God willing, there are many decades ahead of him. And with only one kidney, he doesn't have the backup system that that second kidney represents. So so tell us how you and your older son are doing with only one kidney.
We're just managing to take fluids properly, to keep hydrating ourselves, and we are just taking care of our diet also, not have overly salt, you know, consumption of salt and things like that can be a little lower.
Right.
But watch your diet a little. Be conscious about what you eat and drink. It doesn't matter at all because, you know, you can live. We can live. My son has to learn that he has, as you said, so many decades more of his life. So he needs to maintain his health and see that he doesn't get into a problem.
Right.
Because he was fully, you know, like check the whole thing. He was, you know, his he had a lot of... before the transplant, everything was, you know, he was checked completely and everything was fine. He didn't have any trace of diabetes. God forbid it should not come, but, you know, so things were normal for him. So I hope and pray that he'll be fine and both my children will be good because I hope all the trials and tribulations are over and we just have some peaceful life ahead.
For sure, but in any event, for the donor, as long as you're sensible and take reasonable care of your health, there's really no impact on your lifestyle or your health, right?
Yeah, there's nothing. There's nothing to worry. But of course,
right,
you have to see that alcohol consumption is low. You know, things like that, because these are the things that could lead to something in the future. So you just have to watch.
Right, so those are sensible things that we all ought to be doing anyway.
Yeah,
and you mentioned earlier how what a wonderful feeling it was for you to be able to help your son.
Yes, I felt nice. I felt that that is what a mother is there for. If a child is a problem, whether I was consciously the person who allowed him to get into this situation is not material. The fact that he had that problem, I should be the one to first resolve it for him. I should be there for my children for anything that they go through. And that's what
I
felt when
I
gave him.
For me, too, it was such a helpless feeling watching him go through all the problems that he was going through before and on dialysis. And then to be able to actually do something that really made such a wonderful change for him,
yeah,
it just felt marvelous for me.
Yeah.
I would do it again
and
in
a minute
if I had the opportunity.
Yeah, I don't want you to have. I want you to be in good health. I want your son to be in good health. Never have that opportunity in your life. Let it go on for as long as it can, you know?
For sure.
That's
for
the
sure.
biggest. Because when my son lost the kidney in 2006, it was so devastating. I just said, now, how will he manage his life? Because, you know, it's so difficult to be on dialysis again. To go back into dialysis is the worst thing that can happen. You know, so let us all hope and pray that people who receive their kidneys can enjoy their kidney for a longer time and that they don't have a kidney failure again.
Right. So we should all appreciate our kidneys and take really good care of them because they do many more things than we can even imagine. And we should appreciate them more. We're taking them for granted. And hopefully everybody is able to keep their kidneys in good working order for their whole lives, because they really do a fabulous job for us, even if we don't realize it. So I want to thank you so much for writing this wonderful little book. You share so many insights into living with any chronic problem as far as that goes, and the way that the family rallied around your son and has really made it possible for him to get through a wonderful education, and I'm sure he'll make a marvelous contribution to the world. And also to understand what it's like to deal with dialysis and to deal with transplant. So if someone is facing this, I would really recommend that you read this wonderful little book. It's, again, called Shades of Life, and the subtitle is Sublime Joy is in Living, and it really is how a young man's journey through kidney disease helped his family find meaning in their own lives. And again, it's by Vasundhara Ramanujan, Ramanujan, and it's available from Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble, right?
Yeah, and Borders also.
And Borders also, right.
Yes.
Okay. So
all major websites have them, you know?
Through all the websites, for sure. Don't know if your local bookstore will have a copy, but you can certainly buy it online. So I hope that you will enjoy Shades of Life. So, Mrs. Ramanujan, thank you so much for being with us today. And is there anything else you'd particularly like to leave with our listeners before we say goodbye?
I want to say that you are a perfect host. You actually made the whole conversation much more interesting than I did. But I'm very grateful to you for giving me this opportunity to discuss this book with you and to see that what my message was is finally, reaches the people, as many as the listeners are who have connected on this show. Thank you so much for
Thank you very much for joining us from India, and we wish you well. We wish your sons well and your husband and all your family. And thank you very much for sharing this experience with us.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye now. And bye-bye to everybody. Thank you so much for being with us today. And we hope that you will be with us again next time. And be sure to be well and be a powerful patient. Bye-bye.